Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, oh, sorry. We were looking for Chumba Casino. That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus.
Terms and conditions apply. See website for details. Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Eric Olson. It is time once again for America's Most Haunted. Very exciting show tonight. We are veering off into uncharted waters. I didn't know there was an actual meaning to urban fantasy. So we're going to hear about that from author Rhiannon Held, who is with us this evening. Rhiannon is author of the Silver Series, an urban fantasy about werewolves from Tor. In her day job, she works as a professional archaeologist. Unfortunately, given that it's real rather than fictional archaeology, fedoras, bullwhips, aliens, and dinosaurs are in short supply, which doesn't say they're non-existent, by the way. Most of her work is done on the computer, using databases to organize data and graphics programs to illustrate it. Oh, it's more exciting than that. In Reflected, the new book, the third in the series, it began with her debut novel, Silver, Rhiannon Held, continues the secret lives of the werewolf packs that live and hunt alongside human society. Silver and her mate, Andrew Dare, are pack leaders of the entire North American werewolf population, and that makes the more traditional packs in Europe very nervous indeed. Welcome, Rhiannon. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, the pleasure is ours. I see Teresa, the world-famous haunted housewife, coming and going out of the switchboard, so it would appear she's having some sort of technical issues, but I'm certain she will be with us shortly. Well, as I always do, as our regular listeners will note, I almost never finish a book, but I did get pretty far into this, and it took me a while to figure out what was going on, because it is the third book in the series, especially this sort of bizarre personality of Silver, this female werewolf. And so rather than mess with that in terms of what we should or should not give away, it would be outstanding if you gave us a little bit of background. It would help me, too, on the first two books of the series and just kind of set things up, and we'll go from there. Because, by golly, I am equally interested in your archaeology. My son is an archaeologist.
Oh, cool. Cool.
Small world, huh?
Yeah. let's see. Background on the first two books. Okay. So first off, the thing that you should know is this is sort of where the archaeology comes in a little bit. I sort of made my werewolves a bit sort of scientific, so they're only born, not cursed or anything like that. So they have their sort of own culture that they're hiding from humans, and they have their own religion and that sort of thing, which kind of underpins the series. So in the first book, Silver is discovered sort of stumbling around because she's been attacked and injected with silver nitrate, which has caused her some brain damage. So she thinks she's seeing the spirit realm of their religion, worship of the moon, the lady. And the guy who finds her, Andrew Dare, figures she's just hallucinating. And so what they have to do in book one is work together, because she's forgotten what's happened to her, and he needs to figure out who did this and why, and make sure it doesn't happen again to any other werewolves. So that's the first book. They work together, and they find the werewolf that was doing it, and they take him down. So then in the second book...
As well they should. Rat bastard.
Exactly. In the second book, it gets a little bit more sort of political, because what happened in book one is they realized that Andrew's former alpha was pretty incompetent. And so Andrew has an overdeveloped sense of responsibility, so he figures that he can't let people get hurt by this incompetence. He needs to take over from his alpha. So book two is about him and Silver working together. pardon me, I have a bit of a cold. To maneuver that Alpha out of office, as it were.
Got it. And then this is the third book, Reflected.
This is the third book.
What are the basic rules? That's what often really fascinates me as you move, whether it's a movie or a TV show or a book series. The really interesting part, or one of the really interesting parts, are what are the rules? Because they always vary to a certain extent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the I based all of mine, as I said, on that sort of scientific principle, which actually gets something from evolutionary theory, of all things, which is something I have a background from my academic training in anthropology, which is the idea that if something about the species in this case being werewolves, helps them survive, then they're going to have more children and pass on their genes, and so that survival trait will become part of the species. So, for instance, my werewolves, they really, really want to shift into wolves when the moon is full, but they don't have to. They can kind of sweat it out. And the reason for that is if you think about a mob with pitchforks and torches chasing a couple of werewolves, and one of them has to turn into a wolf in the full moonlight. And so people say, aha, she's the werewolf, and they pitchfork her to death. And she is not having any kids or passing on her genes. Whereas the other werewolf that can kind of sit there and be like, oh, yeah, I'm one of you. Let me pick up a torch here. I'm one of you, is the one who then has children. So that trait of being able to not have to shift during the full moon gets passed on. So I sort of looked at my werewolves in that sense. So they don't have to shift during the full moon, but it's easier. They want to. They get itchy, but they don't have to. They have their first shift at puberty, because the idea of having a little kid sort of bumbling around, shifting back and forth, that would be a lot for them to handle.
It'd be cute, though.
Yes, it would be very cute. I'm sometimes sad that I can't have little wolf cubs around. But, of course, you can have wolf cubs if the werewolf conceives in wolf form. Then the werewolf babies would be born as wolves.
Oh.
Which is a sort of interesting situation, because as I figure it, wolves reach sexual maturity at about 2 years old. So I figure at that point, the little wolf, werewolf babies turn into humans, but then they're a little human toddler. And so then they stay inhuman until then they grow to human maturity, you know, 10 or 15 years later.
Got it. Well, and you don't shy away from the call of the wild, so to speak, since book three opens with young adults, shall we say, chasing each other about, sniffing around, which leads to an unfortunate accident.
Yes. Well, actually, book three is kind of interesting because I have ramped up the sort of sexual side of the wolves' lives, what's shown on screen a little bit, because in the first books, they're certainly very sexual, but you don't necessarily see it on screen or on camera or whatever, as it were, on the page.
Right.
And the reason that I did it in book three was because there's something I've noticed with teenagers a lot in sort of urban fantasy, which is that when they have sex, it's often A, birds and bees sex, or B, bad choices with bad consequences. So the birds and bees sex is when two people love each other very much. So then it's all sweet, and they love each other, and maybe it's puppy love, but yay. And then bad choices with bad consequences, if they don't love each other, oh, then, you know, maybe they enjoy it now, but oh, you know, bad things are going to happen, be it pregnancy or disease or emotional drama or cheating or whatever.
Boy. Death, and man. So, we're talking horror, you know. Sex equals death in horror, as everyone knows.
Yes. No, of course, I'm not right for urban fantasy.
Sluts die.
So what I wanted to do was actually counter that. I wanted to fill in, I think, what's a missing choice for teens in written fiction in some genres, which is intimacy. Like, why can't you just have sex with somebody that you like and try to minimize drama a little bit, and then you grow up and you get on with your lives and you're not together forever because it wasn't about love. It was just about exploring yourself and exploring your sexuality with someone you trusted. Like, why
you like in the real world?
Teens have that? I know, right?
Isn't that what college is for?
Exactly. So I wanted to give my characters an example of doing that, you know, so people could look at it and be like, yeah, I recognize that. That speaks to my experience as opposed to, you know, just love or bad consequences. And it also, it speaks to where society, because my werewolves, if you think about it, they can heal a bit better so they aren't worried about disease. They don't have to worry about getting AIDS or anything like that.
Wow.
And the second thing is that they're not as fertile as humans, and so children are relatively rare. So any teenager who did accidentally get pregnant could instantly adopt the child into their pack or with a relative or raise it themselves and have lots of help because of the communal living because of having a pack. So it's not some kind of straitjacket to what they're going to be able to do with their life. So there's not the fear and the societal pressure involved to try to keep them from having the negative consequences, because the negative consequences, obviously the sort of emotional harm that you can come to by being intimate with someone who then doesn't treat you well, that's still there. But the disease and the pregnancy isn't a big thing for werewolves. So I was thinking, well, that would really change their behavior a lot. So I sort of tried to illustrate one way that that might turn out.
Outstandingly explained. Almost like a scientist with...
It's funny that bleeds through.
I believe that Teresa, the world-famous haunted housewife, is now with us. Are you, Teresa?
I am. I had a little technical difficulty, I think. So sorry I didn't join you at the very beginning of the show. But hello, Rihanna. Welcome.
Hello.
I'm digging this talk about werewolves. I've got lots of questions.
Get on it.
I'm on it, man. The werewolves that you write about, so your books, they don't follow the rules that have been set up in previous werewolf books or in the fictionalized idea that society has of werewolves. I mean, I'm thinking right away of that show Bitten, which I don't really care for. But even in Being Human, and it's everywhere, you know, past, present, future, all the werewolf shows. Your werewolves aren't, they don't mate for life like a wolf does, or they have more human qualities when it comes to the opposite sex, or is it different when they're in human form or different when they're in wolf form?
Well, actually, that's an interesting question, because a lot of my characters haven't been sort of around long enough to really put the mate for life thing to a good road test, because I think the thing with, now, I would have to look it up to be sure, but I think the thing with sort of true wolves is that they do mate for life, but if one of the pair dies, then they will mate again. So it's sort of pragmatic in a way. And so biologically, I tried to sort of go from the principle that pragmatism and having more children to pass on your genes and survive sort of would rule the day, and so even if you would like to stay with one mate for life, if they get killed or something like that, you're not going to pine away. But I do base a lot of my werewolf behavior on humans just because wolves and other animals can be fairly simple. If you're hungry, you get some food, and you have some sort of social rules about making sure the food gets distributed or something like that, right? But it's fairly simple. It's still hungry, get food, try to make sure everybody gets food, the end. Whereas humans, something that you learn very quickly in anthropology is that we can make absolutely anything so complicated and so fraught with meaning and ritual and etiquette. I mean, think about going to a restaurant with your family and who sits where, and does anybody pull out their chair, and who leads the conversation, and did somebody bring a bottle of wine as a present, and if you're at a restaurant, who pays, and blah, 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 all this stuff that almost results in food being the least priority of all of this. And so when I look at structuring the werewolf society, I always think about, okay, so I've studied wolf pack behavior and blah, 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 but what the werewolves are going to do is take the human meaning and ritual and etiquette and just slather that on top, and so that everything is important and has social rules and moral codes and all this sort of stuff. And so that's where the complexity comes from, not just find a mate, have some kids, genes survive, yay, you know, but fidelity and loyalty and finding a mate who's a good fit for your personality and just all kinds of stuff is what the humans are sort of bringing to the party.
Excellent. Yeah, I think what you said about food. Food, for a lot of animals, I guess, they eat to live, and a lot of humans, at least in the Western society, we live to eat, and it does become very ritualized, and I quite enjoy it myself, so, you know, I'm not knocking it. I'm just saying, you know, it's gone beyond serving a purpose to keep us alive, and it becomes something more enjoyable. But now, going off track a little bit, because this was actually going to be my first question, but then we started talking about sex. So I got diverted. I'm curious about the names that you chose for your wolves, and I'm assuming there was some thought put into this, in the Roanoke Territory, and your wolf is Andrew Dare.
Mm-hmm. That's okay. So
is there any connection to the whole Virginia Dare story and the lost colony of Roanoke? Does that tie in some way in
yes.
the story?
Yes, and if... people are interested in hearing more about that, the book one, I go into it in a little bit more detail. Pardon?
That's so intriguing. I'm like dying to know. Because I didn't read, I haven't read it, so I'm like, ooh, you know, that caught my eye immediately.
The idea is that I've sort of figured out the broad strokes of where the werewolf species arose on planet Earth and when and where they sort of migrated and that sort of thing. And not all of it makes it onto the page, but the Roanoke colony is part of the werewolf characters that I have on the page, their sort of background and their own sort of personal histories. So the idea is that the werewolves aren't native to North America. Even if they were around at the time, they didn't come over on the Bering Land Bridge. When Europeans started colonizing the New World, werewolves sort of looked and thought, oh, you know, lots of land, that's a good thing, but they wouldn't have wanted to go over on the ships because it's a journey of months, and so that's several full moons where you really have to control yourself. And if you think about shipboard travel at that time, it sounds pretty damn miserable being down in the hold cooped up.
Ugh.
And
they're tiny.
Know, exactly.
The ships
sort of
were tiny
in your
no
own
escape.
Waist. And, yeah. So what they did was they sort of grafted themselves onto the Roanoke expedition. There were a couple expeditions, and so the one that's famous that was lost was one of the sort of, I think, the third or something like that. And so they joined that expedition and a good portion of the colonists were werewolves. And so what happened is that they got over and they sort of settled in, and then the supply ships that were supposed to come didn't. And everybody was getting pretty hungry, except for the werewolves who would go and hunt. And so they had plenty of extra food. And so people sort of started eyeing them, being like, why are these people so well-fed looking? And I haven't established in the books, I've left it sort of a mystery since the characters themselves don't know, but the were mythology is that what happened is that the werewolves and the humans clashed, and so then the werewolves sort of were like, whatever, and turned into wolves and sort of ran off west into North America. and left the humans there to sort of struggle on, and eventually some join the natives and some die off, is what seems to be the evidence for the colony in the real world. So the Dare surname, Virginia Dare is supposed to be the first European born on North America. In my mythology, she was the first werewolf as well, because her father was a werewolf.
Yeah, but what about the Vikings? Archaeologist woman?
Well, the Vikings certainly came over here, but they would be subject to the same trouble with shipboard travel times. And so when you're sort of going off and exploring, you're especially going to be cooped up on the ship for longer because you don't know quite what you're going towards. So if there were werewolves in Scandinavia at that time, I haven't specifically said anything about
it. Decided?
Yeah, exactly. I haven't decided.
Because you're the god of this world, with a small g.
What would have happened is they would have seen these sort of exploration expeditions going off towards who knows what, taking who knows how long in a stinking ship full of humans, which would not have attracted them at all, shall we say. They would not have joined up with those expeditions.
And we know how small those Viking ships were. Boy, there's no escape there either.
Yeah, exactly.
That is fascinating stuff. One of the things that you haven't mentioned yet, you know, and that was a excellent recitation of your universe and your rules, but how did you decide to go the route of the either or, the full shift, as opposed to the wolf-man type hybrid? I've always really been fascinated why creators of again, whatever, books, movies, TV, decide to go one route or the other.
Mm-hmm. For me, it was simply a decision of I wanted to make them other but not monstrous. And so I saw the sort of in-between wolf-man, wolf-human sort of mixture as being much more of a monster that people would identify with versus being wholly human in body or wholly wolf in body. And now, sort of in our culture, we're slowly coming to the point where wolves are just animals rather than rawr, monstrous things in and of themselves. And so I wanted to give that feeling of they are just another sort of biological creature. And I thought that the readers would identify with them being more as just another biological creature if they saw them as human or fully wolf rather than a weird mixture that doesn't occur in nature that we know.
Yeah, that we knew. Interesting, really interesting. All right, so then the obvious sort of archetypal foundational question is, why werewolves in the first place? What drove you, what compelled you, an archaeologist sitting at her computer doing your archaeological thing, to get into fiction A and werewolves in particular? Oh, one other question just before I forget, because my poor brain, it's always darting
sure.
left and right, kind of like silver. I noticed the way you use the word were, and I'm wondering, are there any other weres besides the wolves in the series, or is that just short for werewolf?
It's just short for werewolf. What it is that you'll notice in the book, were is capitalized, and how they use it is sort of like their name for their people, whereas werewolf is a biological species. So I would say an American with a capital A who is a human, and they would say I'm a were with a capital W who is a werewolf. And that's how they use it, to sort of give an idea of their conception of themselves, not just as a species, but as a culture and a people who have a past and a shared religion and things like that.
Very
interesting. I will, when I'm doing interviews, I sometimes try to keep myself to werewolf so people don't get confused, but you'll have noticed I'm slipping up because when I'm writing, I'm talking about the were people, so that's what that's about.
Got it. So now, why werewolves in the first place?
Why werewolves? Well, back when I was writing short stories, before I even thought of writing a novel, I was reading a lot of urban fantasy myself. And that was when urban fantasy was just sort of starting to bloom into having a lot more novels in it. And back in those days, it was very heavily vampires and somewhat lesser degree werewolves. And so I enjoyed it, and I noticed that a lot of what seemed like was the possibilities for vampires had been exhausted. They'd been done all kinds of different ways, done as monsters, done as sexy, done as this, done as that, done as sparkling. Werewolves had been done a little bit, but what I noticed was that werewolves were often done sort of as just another type of monster very like a vampire, because they would have the same underlying thread of the temptation towards violence and the temptation towards a baser nature and instincts that couldn't be controlled and sort of similar thematic issues. And I looked at it and I thought, so vampires, they have those thematic issues covered. You know, if we're using monsters as a metaphor for drug use, yeah, totally, vampires, we're done. So werewolves, why not reinvent them and sort of break them off and have them be a metaphor for something different? And so that's what I wanted to do, was change some aspects of werewolves so that they had different themes than just another sort of vampire light, or a hairier, more violent vampire. So in my books, I'm trying much more for a theme of an immigrant culture, somebody who worships one way at home, but then comes to the workplace and everybody is celebrating different holidays, and they learned a different language at home, and then they got to speak a different language at school. And how much do they assimilate into the dominant culture, and how much do they keep the culture of their ancestors? And with the whereas I have them, since they're staying secret from humans, there's the aspect of they have this minority culture at home, and they can't talk about it at all. They have to pretend that they don't have it. So it's about the struggle of being an outsider and how much of your culture you want to keep, rather than the struggle against temptation or drug use or baser nature or all that sort of stuff. And the other reason I like werewolves is because people already know what you're talking about, so you can hit the ground running. Because vampires, werewolves, things like that, people are kind of like, okay, so full moon, involuntary or not? Not involuntary. Oh, cool. Sort of middling man-wolf form, yes or no? No. Okay, cool. And then they already have a sense of how werewolves are going to work in their head, and at that point I can start telling the story. Whereas if I chose something like, say, a gargoyle or something, people would like be like, wait, so is it humanoid at all, or is it this little like winged bat thing? And is it made out of stone? How does stone move? So wait, stone is, it's only stone half the time, so then how does it eat? And how do you get baby gargoyles? Like, you have to spend so much time getting the reader on the same page as to how this gargoyle thing is going to work, that meanwhile you don't have as much space or time to be talking about this gargoyle's longing for home or something like that. And so I decided that that it's not a bad way to go to have some new creature that you show to the reader, because the readers like new things and you can tell different types of stories with them. But if you want to talk about a theme of longing for home or cultural dominance or something like that, it's easier to use something they already know about so that you get right to your theme.
Got it. Very interesting. Sounds like you've thought about some of this before, maybe.
A little.
Teresa.
Was it your plan to make a series with the werewolves, or did one book just kind of sprout into a series organically, or did you kind of have the stories laid out in your head before you began writing?
I don't plan very far ahead. I have maybe a couple books ahead with a seed of an idea, but certainly not outlined or anything like that. When I wrote the first book, I honestly don't remember. I just knew that I wanted to write a novel. But by the time I finished the first book, I'd figured out that there was more things that could happen to the characters, and I knew that I was really interested in finding out what would happen to the characters. So by the time I was revising book one, I knew that it was going to be a series, but I didn't know how long. I just knew that the characters had legs. And so where I am right now is that Tor bought the first three, and then I'm waiting to find out if they want to buy more. So I've planned ahead a bit more than I might usually to give them an outline for 4, 5, 6 so that they can have something to look at and maybe buy 4, 5, 6. That would be great. and then I have an idea for 7, but then after that, I think I start to hit the point where if you have a series focused on a couple characters, in each book I want to have a definite arc where the character changes, but at some point there are only so many changes, deep sort of personality and life changes that one character can have happen to them. And so I want to let one set of characters sort of like settle down and live quiet lives finally and pick up with a new set of characters that have more sort of emotional battles left to fight in their life. They're still figuring themselves out in a certain way. And so then that gives me nice, meaty sort of emotional arcs to bite into with them. But as I say, it depends how many my publisher wants.
It seems like three is the magic number with these type of novels, the ones that are seem to be really popular, and especially the ones that are getting made into movies. It's almost like you need to have a series in order to propel the story along with culture. I think maybe that speaks to how easily we are as a people just on to the next thing, like, okay, you've got our attention, and now what's next? What happens next? What happens next? And even the fact that they're putting movies out so quickly, and maybe you find this as an author, that you have to keep putting books out more rapidly because the appetite for especially urban fantasy and dystopian novels and some of these other sci-fi type novels, they just seem to be enormously popular and gaining more every day, which I think is great because I love it. I love the entire genre, everything. And it's interesting when they do make it to film how different sometimes they can be for the book. Do you see this as a possibility with the Silver series or any of your novels possibly being made into movies?
Well, I mean, I suppose it's a possibility that I could win the lottery, though in that case I probably would have to buy more tickets than I do. But when you crunch out the numbers, I don't have them on hand, but I've heard other authors talk about it, the possibility of a given author getting a particular book, seeing it actually on the screen is about similar to the lottery. Because there's several steps along the way. Not only do you have to have somebody look at it and agree to buy the option or whatever, then there's a lot of scripts that get written that don't get made or books that get bought to make into movies but scripts don't get written or just there's so many places along the way where it can fall off. And so standing on the end, you look at the box office and you say, oh, well, there are X number of movies with werewolves about them. But then if you come back to the point where you're the author and you have a book and you look at, you know, several orders of magnitude more books with werewolves coming out every year that don't end up in the box office, the chances are pretty darn low. I mean, it would be great. I would love it. But it seems like it would also carry its own problems because books are struggling with the idea of portraying diversity, and Hollywood is lagging very, very far behind on that. And so you can have a diverse book then becoming a much less diverse movie, which can be quite frustrating, I would imagine, for the author. among just the other sort of things that you hear authors saying, that, you know, they didn't get the spirit of what I was trying to do with it, you know.
I think there's so much more freedom with when you're writing, when you don't have to worry about that, and you don't have to fit into a mold that Hollywood has set up for you. So maybe it's not the financially the most ideal way to live, but just to write for the idea of writing and to get your ideas down on paper. I mean, just the fact that my daughter reads constantly and she devours books. She loves all the young adult books and all the urban fantasy. She reads them all, but she almost will strictly refuse to see any of the films because they become so disappointing for her. She enjoys so much more the novel, the book, and the story and all the detail and everything that can be put into it. And I think that's such a beautiful thing. I love that, that she really can just appreciate the joy of the written word and be able to have such a richer story that way. So, and I think sometimes, and I'm not speaking for myself, but I mean, I know people who write, and I think they're writing books now with the intention of them being turned into movies, and I think that's a shame.
Yeah.
I don't think they're doing themselves any favors.
Yeah, well, it's a very different medium, and I think that the movies that have been successful, for instance, I've read the Hunger Games trilogy, and so far I've been enjoying the movies, and they're not a faithful filming of the book, and they're not even a faithful filming of the book with parts cut out for time. There are new things in the movie that weren't in the book, which I think is because they're aware of the fact that you can do different things with a movie than a book. They have different strengths, and so I think the really, really good movies are the ones that say, okay, we're using the source material, but we're then going to look for all the ways that we can play to the visual medium's strengths. And so if I was to imagine my books ever being a TV show or a movie or something like that, I'd really want to get in with a really good screenwriter because I don't have that background to translate something on the page into something that works well in the pacing and the timing and the whatever of a visual medium. And I've heard that Suzanne Collins, you know, had a background in that sort of visual type of style, which is why she could sort of help the movies play to visual strengths. And I know I definitely don't have that, so I'd have to find somebody who could help me with it. If we're imagining what might be nice to happen.
Why not? Imagine away. Now, what is your description of urban fantasy, and who is the theoretical for that?
That's a good one. 'Cause often I end up defining urban fantasy by what it isn't, because people often say, oh, isn't that like paranormal romance? And so a lot of times I'm like, oh, no, urban fantasy isn't paranormal romance because blah, 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 blah. But the way I see urban fantasy is it's a way to take the magic and the supernatural of traditional fantasy and put it in a world that we would recognize. And so it transforms the world that we recognize and makes us see that world in a new way, and it also makes us see the magic in a new way because it's in this frame of elements we recognize, so we're really looking closely at that magical supernatural element and not looking at everything else around it that's also strange, and so there's so much strangeness that we don't even know what's going on that is something you can get into with a really immersive traditional fantasy. So personally, I would not get into, it's not urban fantasy because it happened in a bayou, and that's not a city. I don't get into that at all. I feel that if it's a contemporary feeling world, it doesn't matter where it is. And where the line can get kind of blurred is I think that something set very rural can start to have a timeless sort of historical, not quite contemporary feel. You know, you're in a little town and you don't see a lot of technology and nobody has cell phones or locks their doors and they're not driving around a lot. And so you can start to feel timeless And if you add magic to that, I think then it's becoming something slightly different than urban fantasy. But if you're out in the woods outside of a cabin, but you've got your cell phone and you're going to tweet to Facebook about a werewolf that you saw, I feel that still has the feeling of a modern world that we recognize quite strongly, then juxtaposed with the magical element. And so I would call that urban fantasy. And then where it would butts paranormal romance is that a lot of urban fantasy has romantic elements in it. But paranormal romance, the point is the romance, and whatever's
right.
going on is supporting that romance. And so, you know, if goblins are attacking, then that sort of forces the two leads to have a confrontation that allows them to see that they really love each other or whatever. So the goblins serve the emotions that are going on between the leads. Whereas in urban fantasy, the goblins are the point. And maybe there's some emotional thing that happens, but we're focusing on the goblins and the emotional things that we need to do and go out and fight them and win and save the day and all that sort of stuff that's more focused on the emotions of dealing with the sort of external plot as opposed to coming to the romance.
So urban fantasy, men are allowed to read it, in other words.
Yes. That's what I was going to say next, which is the audience thing that you're asking
right.
about. Because I think yes. that urban fantasy could have a wider audience than it gets slotted into. Because people do sort of slot it with the romance, which is assumed that it's going to be for women. But urban fantasy can have all kinds of really, like, fast action elements or political machinations or interesting, cool stuff that is not the sort of sappy emotional stuff that might drive some men away. And I actually came to urban fantasy myself when I was so busy that I didn't have time to sort of open a fantasy book and learn yet another world and yet another lineage of kings and blah, blah, blah. I would read a page of that, and then I would, like, have to do my grad school homework, and then I would come back 2 weeks later and read another page and be like, wait, what? King? Who did what?
Start over.
What now?
Whereas
urban fantasy, I opened it, and I'm like, oh, okay, they're in Chicago. I know what Chicago is, and they just met a witch. And then I come back 2 weeks later, and I open another page, and I'm like, oh, look, the witch just ordered a pizza. Like, it was much easier to get into the flow of what's happening, and I think that urban fantasy could be great for a lot of people out there who don't necessarily have a lot of time to read around their job or whatever, because it's a cool magical element, but they can get to the story really quickly. And so I think a lot of people could enjoy it. Maybe they will, maybe they won't. But
what is your guess? Well, certainly what I've read so far did not offend my masculine side. So that's good. Just off the top of your head, because it sounds like you know a lot about kind of everything, what's your guess on the readership percentage, readership of romance? Or, I mean, you can make it specific paranormal romance, which I know is exploding. You know, I get 70-some Google alerts every day because I'm trying to kind of broadly as possible cover the paranormal world, both the real world and the media world. And, God, it seems like every other alert I get is some sort of, you know, paranormal romance book. And there's all these blogs and all these women just up in arms going crazy and drooling and arguing and gnashing their teeth and seem to be really, really into it. And, you know, I can just tell from the cover, this is not for me. So, anyway, I'm just wondering what you think the percentage of readers of, for example, paranormal romance versus urban fantasy?
That's an interesting question. I would suspect, though I don't know, you're cornering a scientist and making her speak without data.
my evil
I would
plot.
Suspect paranormal romance is majority women readers. And urban fantasy, I'm not sure, because there's definitely the elements of it. For instance, Jim Butcher's Harry Dresden books, I think, have a lot of male readership. And so I don't know. What I would be interested in is if men who read the Harry Dresden books, whether they stick around in the genre or whether they sort of just go about their business and don't come back to the genre at all. Because I think that would be the point of entry for men. Because I know that even in my own reading, if it's something unfamiliar and it seems like the kind of thing that I probably wouldn't like, for instance, military SF, military science fiction, not really quite my cup of tea, but I really enjoy the author David Weber. And so I will read David Weber's stuff. And if there was other military science fiction that said, this is just like David Weber, I might try that. And so I would see that the more sort of points of entry we have, like the Jim Butcher, Harry Dresden books for men, where then other urban fantasy books might be labeled as, this is just like Harry Dresden, then that might sort of get them into the genre a bit more, because I suspect right now there aren't many, there are probably more male readers in urban fantasy than paranormal romance, but there still probably aren't as many as some other sort of speculative fiction genres. And that's probably just because of the cultural assumptions. You know, we're a very, very gendered society. And there's all this stuff that women should do and men shouldn't, and all this stuff that men should do and women shouldn't, we're told. And it's hard to sort of break free of that. So I'm never surprised when society sort of doesn't manage to quite break free yet of those sort of gendered assumptions.
I think certainly we live in a time that is much more open to you know, a more fluid approach.
Sure.
And I think we're less inclined to really pin people down kind of point by point by point. And not just people, but whatever we might be talking about, including fiction. But I do think I just don't know if we're going to ever truly transcend some of these differences that just I hope I don't sound, you know, reactionary. There do seem to be some, and I don't know if they're fundamental. I mean, my guess is there's something fundamental in there that just sort of leads people, and you know what it is? It's not predictive. It's not person by person. It's just statistics. You know what I mean? That's kind of why I was asking you what you thought some of the numbers were, because individuals can mostly do what they want. And if you go person by person and sort of make a list of their characteristics and their traits and their interests and inclinations, then I think most people, certainly most, you know, Western, quote-unquote, contemporary-type people, have mostly neutral, you know, mostly general neutral characteristics. And they aren't, you know, really hard, pigeonholed in a hard way. But I think there are some fundamental kind of underlying things that just seem to be the way people are inclined. And whether it's really, really deep down genetic or it really just is cultural, you know, that I don't know. But think how deep culture goes, you know. I mean, there's been humans now for modern humans for, what is it? Is it 200,000 years or 100,000 years that we've said modern humans?
Anatomically modern humans, I think, is 100,000. I don't know. That would be another thing I'd have to look up.
You are archaeologist.
The things that I worry about is 40,000 is the first good evidence of culture, sort of cave paintings, burials, that sort of thing.
Right.
In anatomically
so
modern humans.
So cultural humans. Cultural here,
yeah.
Which probably is much more relevant. I think you're absolutely right. So, but still, 40,000 years, that's a long time. That's a lot of generations. And, you know, as far-flung as the many, 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 many cultures of the world. And, of course, today it's very hard to kind of tease it all out exactly because of all the communication, ease of travel, and especially just, whoa, look at the last 20 years with, you know, with the Internet. Now you really do have a very small world. But even so, you still have some relatively isolated cultures out there beating the bushes, literally, figuratively. And, you know, even there, the range is not as wide as one might think. Sure, you have polyandry. I don't know, does that still exist anywhere? You have polyandry, you know, you have polygamy with your at your two poles in terms of, you know, the family relationship, and then with the vast majority of mankind, some form of serial monogamy, I guess, at least theoretically. Yep. And, you know, but still, even within that, the statistics are just, you know, relatively small of the outliers. So I have the sense that there are differences. And past a certain point of a level of depth, it seems like it's almost impossible to distinguish the cultural from the genetic. Is there a genetic cultural? Is there a cultural genetic memory? I mean, can it be so ingrained that it becomes genetic, or is it always kind of overlaid, do you think, culture?
Oh, man. See, how I usually solve that sort of nature versus nurture troublesome argument in my books is I'm like, okay, however it got there, this is what my readers are going to be coming from. Since I'm not translated yet, you know, it's in English, and so if they're reading English in whatever country, there's a certain sort of probable globalization and Western sort of society bias. And so these Western cultural values, however they got there, that's what we're stuck with. And they don't change easy. And so whatever I'm doing with trying to show something different, it's going to be more of a pushing nudge than it is something like radically different. If I'm going to speak to people. And so I'm just like, however it got there, this is what I'm dealing with. And so whenever I'm doing something with, like, having different gender definitions for my werewolves or something like that, I'm very aware of the fact that maybe I won't make them too different, not because there's a biological basis and so they wouldn't be too different, but because I'm trying to speak to my readers. And my readers will get the most out of something that they can somewhat recognize and will speak to them that way. And so that's sort of just how I approach my writing, which is, well, however it got there, and it was probably a mixture, we're stuck with it. And so what are we going to do with it now? Because even if it is, if there are the sort of nature genetic underpinnings of it, there's nature genetic underpinnings making us crave fat and simple carbohydrates. And it's terrible for us, and so we need to resist or do something about it or address that. So even if inequalities have underpinnings, that doesn't mean we shouldn't try to stamp them out or address them or nudge ourselves in another direction. And so I think it doesn't really matter where it came from. We should be trying to change it anyway, just in a pragmatic sense, knowing that it's really built in deep means that I decided to go the route of nudging and showing readers something that's a little bit different, maybe makes them think, as opposed to some completely egalitarian utopia where, you know, gender isn't even mentioned, and, you know, which is another way to go, but not the route I decided to go.
Well put. Teresa, what are your thoughts?
I'm curious as to what kind of monsters scared you as a child, and did that influence your choosing werewolves as a basis for your books, or something we're drawn to, like people get drawn to vampires, they see them as romantic type features, or I'm just curious.
Mm-hmm. Well, actually, that's an interesting question, and I think it illustrates how I'm treating urban fantasy as very much not horror, because I was not afraid of anything like werewolves as a kid, and so I'm coming to them from a sort of analytical thinking, oh, what did the werewolves in history mean in the societies that created them, and what did those fears, blah, blah, blah. You know, it's easier to sort of stand outside when you don't have that fear yourself. I was a fairly practical little child, so far as I can remember, and so far as my parents have told me, in that I was very imaginative, but I always knew what was and wasn't real. So I was definitely afraid that burglars were going to break into our house, but I was not afraid of most monsters. There weren't any monsters under the bed or anything like that. I think for a while there I was a little bit afraid of aliens. But that's still a little slightly bit more in the realm of possibility. But burglars were really the big one, which sort of shows you how I'm much more rooted in the daily life and then springboarding off into fantasy being something different and fantasy being something entirely sort of metaphorical, you know.
It's almost like it's the humans that are the monsters and not these quote-unquote monsters that society has named vampires, werewolves, ghosts, whatever it may be. It's actually the humans that seem to be the ones that are the scariest and the most dangerous, which is how I felt as a child, although I believed in everything.
Definitely. Part of the reason that I was never very much behind what I was talking about earlier with the vampires being our struggle against our animal natures is that I don't think humans need an animal nature to do bad things. I really don't. We're perfectly capable of doing it all on our own without animals getting involved. And so the whole, like, oh, they're not violent until the wolf takes over, I'm like, well, actually humans might be more violent than wolves because wolves are worried about survival. So,
in your deepest, darkest recesses of your imagination, your mind, though it sounds like you're very much a scientifically based person, obviously you are an archaeologist, do you have any paranormal beliefs? Have you had any paranormal experiences yourself?
Nope. I'm afraid not, unfortunately. I think from a young age I studied so much about optical illusions, and I've seen so many sort of incidences of sort of weird optical illusions or created memories or things like that in myself that having that happen to me and recognize what it was, then it's easy to see where it would happen in other instances. There was a time when I was camping with my friends, and we thought there were some tents put up in another field because there were these big white sort of blobs. And then we came over the ridge, and what in fact we'd been seeing was the sky with the moonlight was so bright that silhouetted against the darkness of the ground and the darkness of the trees beside it, it made this outline that looked like a white tent. And so, I mean, you look at the sky and you see a tent? That's strange. That makes no sense. But I actually had the experience where I saw the tent, and I was sure it was a tent, and then I walked farther, and I saw, no, that's the sky, and I saw the transition between. And so if I was to see something that didn't make sense, I'm very aware of how much work my brain is attempting to do to take all these, like, weird bits of random photons flinging at it at all times through my optic nerve and make some kind of sense of it, that I'm actually not surprised that my poor brain at some points is just like, oh, whatever. I don't know what that is. I'll make something up. That's sort of how I process the world, is knowing that your brain does the best it can, but sometimes that's just not good enough.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, that's a pretty standard scientific formulation, and I am certain that does explain the vast majority of what is perceived as paranormal. I personally have come to the tentative conclusion, anyway, that even if you boil it down and boil it down and take, you know, very small percentage of a very small percentage of a very small percentage, as long as that you don't end up with zero, there's still something going on. So I think that's where I am. I, you know, I waver when you go from kind of category to category. Probably partly or even mostly because that's what I've been studying and looking into the most and interacting the most, and that's what Teresa does, and we worked on this book together called America's Most Haunted, looking at the most haunted locations, public, semi-public, in the nation and that kind of thing. So I'm pretty well convinced. I'm not sure what it would take at this point for me to come around again to thinking there's nothing going on beyond what we understand in terms of, you know, however you would care to characterize it, spirits, energy, spirit energy, ghosts, et cetera, et cetera. What are commonly called ghosts? When you get into some of these, that I'm at this point pretty sure there's something to. A lot of the other areas, whether it's cryptozoology or aliens, I'm a lot closer to the center. UFOs, I'm pretty sure there is just, again, it's just numbers. Given the immensity of the universe, there probably is alien life. I mean, you know, all the things that just gone just in the last few years, months, the various discoveries. I mean, it appears there may be some form of life, rudimentary life, I mean, as close as our solar system even. So, you know, just based on the numbers, I think that there is alien life out there. I'm not at all convinced, and I'm still kind of leaning away from it, that they've ever been here, however. You know, I don't know what's going on with all what all people see, but it's probably explainable with the things that you said. And I'm right on the fence with Bigfoot. I mean, my goodness, it just seems to be so much evidence on both sides. You know, it's like they cancel each other out. I think of it as the old cliche about football, you know, the line in football, it's the unstoppable forces meeting immovable objects. Yeah. And that's kind of how I feel about Bigfoot. It's just, you know, God, what are all these things going on that all these people see? And there's at least some, quote-unquote, evidence, physical evidence. But on the other hand, why isn't there a body, you know, and all the other things on the other side of it? So my mind is on this sliding scale. And, you know, I talked to my son, who incidentally is a Viking archaeologist or in training.
Okay.
And he is over in Denmark. Actually, right now he's in China because he's with his wife, who is a bog scientist, and they're off bogging in China. And so when I talk to him, he says all the same things you do. You know, to him it's just all can be explained away. And it's interesting, and, you know, he doesn't completely dismiss the possibility that there are things that we don't understand. But he doesn't really think there are fundamental things we don't understand at this point. So, it's interesting to see the ways people's minds are inclined and just to see how my own mind has changed. Because I've gone, the course of my life is zero, when I was young, zero doubt whatsoever. I mean, literally none. That there was a very active, very present spirit world all around me, and I saw things and experienced things, to most of my adult life thinking that is very unlikely, just doesn't seem to make sense, and, you know, why isn't there more actual evidence, you know, why can we not experiment and get results. And now I've kind of moved back somewhere closer to where I was as a kid with the spirit world, but I'm, you know, probably haven't moved that much in these other things. I've always been very interested in mysteries. They fascinate me. They compel me. Why? Why don't we know this? What happened? Mm-hmm. How did this happen? And the intersection of these aspects of life, the paranormal from a non-religious standpoint, how does that intersect with religion? How does that intersect with science? And all of that is amazing to me, and that's why I'm at this stage of my life, focusing my attention and writing and thinking on that. So I completely get where you're coming from, and it makes perfect sense to me, but I do still have this sense that there's something more out there that, you know, maybe it really is perfectly scientific in the long run, because again, mm-hmm. you know, as we know, science, magic is just science we don't know yet,
yep.
for the cliche. But I still have this deep, deep abiding sense that there's something that we'll never exactly understand. So anyway, that's my metaphysics for the day.
Sure.
We are well past the hour mark. What a fascinating conversation. You're a very interesting person. And what I've read, I've got, I guess, about a quarter of the way into the book is outstanding, very readable, and I want to know more and more about these people, and I'm eager to figure out this world. So all of those are very good things, because I'm pretty picky. You know, I can tell pretty real quickly if I'm going to be interested or not, and I will absolutely be finishing this and eager to see where
you.
It goes. So, you know, congratulations on completing a trilogy. That is absolutely an accomplishment, especially for a first-time novelist to have pulled that off and be with a major genre publisher. And you know, I was talking to Tor and saying, okay, well, we would love to talk to one of your authors, and you're the one. You're who they wanted us to talk to. So that is a good sign, I would think. And really interesting stuff. I'm going to kind of contemplate the metaphysics of your fictional world here and think about that. And I really do appreciate how much groundwork you've done and how much you've thought all this out. I think you find that with the better authors, with the more with the more airtight world,
mm-hmm.
There's a lot there that's not on the page, you know, that they've thought out, so that you're still getting the manifestation of all of this thought and preparation, even if you're not specifically laying out every detail of it. You know, it's very, very mythic, and so I think you've been very successful with that. Teresa, parting thoughts? Teresa, are you there? I don't know. We may have lost Teresa. Well, that's okay. Hello? Well, I may be here by myself. Looks like we have dropped calls. All right. Well, anyway, we're well past the 11 o'clock hour. Thank you so much. We're America's Most Haunted. You will find us at AM Haunted on Twitter. You will find us at AM Haunted or Adam Haunted on Facebook. And very, very, very soon, as in days, as in possibly tomorrow, the America's Most Haunted website will finally make its debut upon the world. Very excited about it. We're seeing now what it actually looks like, and it will be well worth the wait to have such a well-designed and robust site. All right. Thanks so much, everyone. Have a great week. We will talk to you very soon.
Okay, round two. Name something that's not boring.
A laundry? Ooh, a book club. Computer solitaire, huh?
Ah, sorry, we were looking for Chumba Casino.
Chumba.
That's right. Chumbacasino.com has over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.